With a title like Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading, it may not be a surprise that Maureen Corrigan would begin the book in this way. It's not that I don't like people, it's just that when I'm in the company of others, even my nearest and dearest, there always comes a moment when I'd rather be reading a book. And for many hours of almost every day, that's what I'm doing. I have a great job, or to be more accurate, cluster of jobs for a bookworm. I read for a living. For the past 16 years, I've been the book critic for the NPR program Fresh Air. Just about every week, I read a new book and review it for Fresh Air's approximately 4.5 million listeners. I get paid to read, to think, to share opinions about literature. I also write a regular mysteries column for the Washington Post. In addition to being a book critic, I'm a professor of literature at Georgetown University. This, my own book, is my attempt to figure out some of the consequences of my prolonged exposure to books and to explore how reading has transformed my life. Hovering over all the ruminations about literature and life that follow is the cosmic question of why so many of us feel compelled to go through life with our noses stuck in a book. I'd like to propose a resolutely earnest answer. All the years I devoted to reading the Victorian sages in graduate school have left their mark on my beliefs about literature. I think, consciously or not, what we readers do each time we open a book is to set off on a search for authenticity. We want to get closer to the heart of things, and sometimes even a few good sentences contained in an otherwise unexceptional book can crystallize vague feelings, fleeting physical sensations, or, sometimes, profound epiphanies. Good writing is writing that's on target, that captures, say, the smell of sizing on a just-sewn garment, the way no other grammatical scramble of words has before. Words of Maureen Corrigan from her 2007 book, Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading, Finding and Losing Myself in Books. Maureen Corrigan has just defined good writing there as writing that's on target, that captures, say, the smell of sizing on a just-sewn garment, the way no other grammatical scramble of words has before. Maureen Corrigan will return to northeastern Pennsylvania the first weekend in August for a gathering dedicated to good writing. It's the Pennsylvania Writers' Conference, 2 days designed for writers and readers, August 5th and 6th, hosted by Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre and its Creative Writing MA and MFA programs. There will be writing workshops, literary panels hosted by editors, film producers, literary agents, publishers, and writers. Jay Perini is an award-winning poet, novelist, and biographer originally from northeastern Pennsylvania, now on the faculty at Middlebury. He will offer the keynote address, and Maureen Corrigan will serve as a session speaker, and her topic, Reviews That Mattered, an overview of reviews that were crucial to the fate of important books, past and present, and why. There will be a question and answer session to follow. When the creative writing program was established at Wilkes, one of the advisors helping to shape the vision was the celebrated American writer Norman Mailer. J. Michael Lennon, co-founder of the Wilkes program, shares this story about Norman Mailer and an insight Mailer had into using reviews of his books to his advantage. This from Dr. Lennon's critically acclaimed biography of Norman Mailer, and it's concerning reviews of the book by Mailer, Barbary Shore. Neither Mailer nor his editors at Reinhardt were prepared for the almost unrelieved nastiness of the reviews, which ran 10-1 unfavorable. Time magazine labeled the novel Small Beer 1984 and called the novel paceless, tasteless, and graceless, a phrase that became etched on the tablets of Mailer's memory. Anthony West in The New Yorker said that the novel had a monolithic, flawless badness, like Mussolini's play about Napoleon. Even the tepid praise of leftist critics like Irving Howe and Harvey Suedos was mixed with negatives. The novel's over-elaborated political debate and dithering plot pleased no one, although some of the characters, Mrs. Guinevere especially, were found to be imaginatively drawn. the British reviews coming after the book's publication by Jonathan Cape in January 1952 were slightly better. V.S. Pritchett praised it, saying that Mailer was the most interesting American novelist to appear since the war. In some of the reviews in both the United States and England, there was some tentative cheering for a novelist trying to break new ground, trying to make lemonade out of lemons. Someone at Reinhardt had the idea of running excerpts from the best and worst reviews side by side. It was a technique that Mailer would rely on for the remainder of his career, usually with excerpts that he personally chose. In the case of Barbary Shore, it may have helped a bit. The novel did make the bestseller list for 3 weeks after it was published on May 24th. That from Norman Mailer, A Double Life by J. Michael Lennon. We had a chance to speak by phone with Maureen Corrigan in anticipation of her return to Wilkes University for the conference August 5th and 6th, and we began by asking about her previous visit.
It was in 2009, and I came up for the summer conference and, you know, met with a lot of writers of all ages and sizes and races and ethnicities, and, you know, it was a lot of fun. It was also very relaxed. I mean, people took their writing seriously, but they didn't take themselves seriously, if you know what I mean, and it was sort of a pleasure to hang out and talk about literature in a setting that didn't feel overly academic.
That gives us a sense that you have a feel for this program. Those of us who are here in the region are certainly impressed with the quality of the faculty and so forth, but the roots in that sense of Mike Lennon and Bonnie Culver and their friendship with Norman Mailer, and Norman Mailer's being on the advisory panel and his dining room table is in the library.
Which I'll have to go and touch. You know? I first met Mike Lennon because he was an enormous help to me. I was putting together a conference here at Georgetown celebrating the 40th anniversary of the March on the Pentagon, and then subsequently Mailer's Armies of the Night, which I revere as one of the great American masterpieces. And Mike was really so kind to me, and in fact was going to intercede for me to get Mailer to come to Georgetown so that I could interview him on stage. But unfortunately, that was the year he died, and he was too ill to make it finally. But the nice thing was that Mailer did know about the conference, and he did know about how much I and so many other people just revere that book.
What's so fascinating in reading about you and your interests in what you do at Georgetown and what you do for all of us when you call our attention to books, your sense of the public intellectual, the curiosity in terms of ideas and not just writing a rip-roaring good story, but people who have concerns about society that can be reflected in literature or creative nonfiction. And I'm so sorry it didn't come off in that way, but it is good that he got to know.
It is good. It made me feel as a reader that I had an opportunity to pay tribute to a writer who I think really pulled off a masterpiece.
And there is a discipline at Georgetown called cultural journalism. Is that something that Mailer would fall under?
He would. You know, it's funny. You caught me at a moment. I'm sitting in my office, and I'm writing up some material for a museum that's going to open in Chicago in 2017 called the Museum of American Writers. And I'm actually just now sitting here writing up a bit of text about Armies of the Night and what an achievement a book like that is as a work of cultural journalism that's really a hodgepodge of journalism and fiction and history, and also manages to get in that American voice, which I think is always a voice that's characterized by humor, by wit. And Mailer, I mean, Armies of the Night is one of the funniest books that we've got in the American canon, as well as one of the most thought-provoking. So, yeah, when you think of cultural journalism, you really do think of works like Armies of the Night, and of course so many of the works that Tom Wolfe wrote, you know, that generation of writers who really managed to take us deep into a scene or a movement or a place and yet inject their own kind of sensibility into the account. I also think of writers like Janet Malcolm, so many of the great New Yorker writers, of course, who are able to do that. You'll follow them anywhere because of their sensibility, of their intelligence, and their voice that comes through in the work.
And for people who don't know Armies of the Night, what was he up to?
Well, first of all, he was up to drinking a lot, which is often the case when Mailer is talking about his adventures. But he's really writing about an anti-war march that took place in Washington, D.C. in October of 1967. It was a march on the Pentagon to protest the Vietnam War. Mailer was invited to come down from New York to speak at the march with other notables, like Robert Lowell, for instance, the poet. And he comes down to Washington, and so he's a participant, but he's also standing apart and of course, being an observer as well. And it's an amazing kind of meditation on history, but also an account about the split between activists of an earlier generation, you know, Mailer's the World War II generation, and then these younger 60s activists. And Mailer feels some sympathy with them, but he also feels alienated from them. And then some of the lunacy of the march itself. I mean, that was the march, somebody out there may remember, in which protesters tried to surround the Pentagon and levitate it into outer space. So Mailer, you know, it's sort of like the book. The march contained everything. It was serious in intent, but then it also had its zany side. And Mailer really gives us one of these great meditations on a country in the 1960s that seems split apart in ways that maybe still have yet to heal.
We have that wonderful image about books being dumped on your doorstep every day. Are you seeing writers exploring in this cultural journalism way these days?
Gosh, you know, I just read Susan Faludi's book, In the Dark Room, which people are talking about a lot this month. And you know, those who haven't heard of it, Susan Faludi is a feminist writer. She's written books like Backlash about, you know, larger social movements and backlash against the second wave feminist movement. This book is very personal. It's also a work of cultural journalism. She writes about her father, who was at the time alive, in his 70s, from whom she had been estranged for 25 years, calling her up from his home in Hungary and letting her know that he's just had a sex change operation and that he's no longer Stephen, he's Stephanie. So part of the book is autobiographical. It's Faludi, you know, talking about reconnecting with this father who perhaps she never knew and now has to come to know in a different way, very profound change. But she's also rippling out in the book and talking about the notion of identity and where it comes from, ethnic, racial, of course, gender identity, historical identity. So I think it's her powers as a journalist and as an observer and a researcher that really lend weight to this book. It would have been a good book anyway if it had just been this autobiographical account of her life and her relationship with her father. But it becomes a much more ambitious book and a much more thought-provoking book about, you know, especially our current ideas about what constitutes identity, because she's able to, again, like Mailer, pull off that trick of being both a participant and an observer in her own story.
Let's take you back to an author who is important to you, and that's Charles Dickens. He was looking around at society and the situation, legal, child welfare, and all of those things, and yet telling ripping good stories, too, and creating compelling characters.
It's such an achievement, and certainly that's one of the reasons why I love Dickens so much. He takes me deeply into whatever world he's creating. I absolutely believe in the authenticity of his characters and their lives. Even though, you know, when you analyze Dickens, those characters are created out of brushstrokes that seem so broad and artificial, and yet he makes them live. And he also manages to work in always the social criticism, the commentary. What's amazing to me about Dickens, too, though, is that compassion and concern for others' welfare, it didn't seem to extend to his own family. And with apologies to the author whose name I've just blanked out on, there was a wonderful book a couple of years ago that traced what happened to all of Dickens' children, especially his sons, most of whom he exiled to Australia at very young ages, you know, to toughen them up and to have them make their own livings. And it just seems like, personally, there was something about Dickens, maybe due to his own deprived childhood, where he was just walled off emotionally from his own children. So, you know, I guess it's a familiar enough tale that a great artist lives in a certain way through his or her work, and yet in person is a very, very different person.
People so much want to meet writers.
Be careful what you wish for.
When so many of us read Dickens when we're young, and you point out that Great Gatsby, for example, when people are reading it, they're too young to get it sometimes in terms of the maturity of a yearning that we may not be privy to when we're that young.
There is, although I'm laughing because since writing my book on the Great Gatsby, I've received so many letters from high school students who've been, you know, they've been very polite and nice, but they've said to me, I really have to argue with your point about the fact that we're too young to read Gatsby. I love Gatsby, and on and on. What I meant by that was, you know, I didn't come to loving Gatsby until certainly my 20s, and I really was drawn into the novel by Nick Carraway's voice and that voice of yearning and regret for his dead friend, Gatsby. And I really feel like you need to be a little older to connect with that voice that's speaking so much of things that have passed that can't be recovered again. When I went back and visited my old high school, something I hadn't done in nearly 40 years as research for my book, I wanted to sit in on classes that were reading Gatsby for the first time, and so I went back to where I read Gatsby for the first time. When I sat in on those classes, though, the kids clued me into the fact that, well, they read Gatsby differently. They see a different Gatsby than I do now, and they very much connected with Jay Gatsby's over-the-top ambitions and his dreams. And I love that. You know, we each of us entered the novel in a different way.
You talk about seeing Gats, the play, where it's all there, but the fact it's language and mood as opposed to the plot, necessarily.
Yeah.
What about language? Because I see that you're an advisor to dictionary. What?
Oh, my God. I think the American language is in my hands. Maybe they better rethink this. It does give me something of a queasy feeling when I get these questionnaires from the American Heritage Dictionary folks who ask me to vote on usage questions and, you know, new words entering the language. I'm no Dr. Johnson, as some listeners are happy to remind me whenever I make a mistake myself in usage, or once in a while even a grammar mistake on air, my God. But, you know, I really feel very lucky in that I've got, I think, the best job in the world for somebody who loves books and who loves writing. Of course, my classes at Georgetown, I get to revisit the classics all the time and books that I think must be reread throughout one's life. And then, you know, as a critic for Fresh Air, I get to opine and weigh in on the latest books coming out. Many of them are fabulous, and I can't keep up with them. You mentioned I get over 200 books a week delivered to my house from publishers hoping for a review on Fresh Air. And if you could see the little row house I share with my husband and daughter in Washington, D.C., it's like the candy store if you love books, but if you don't love books, it's a house of horrors.
What about the radio medium? Is that something that a young Maureen, were you growing up with radio? Was radio a part of your life, or is it something that you've come to love because of being absorbed into it this way through Fresh Air?
Yeah. You know, when I was growing up, I did listen to radio. I mean, we did listen to radio in my house, but of course, I grew up in the 60s, and we were mostly watching TV. And I'm laughing because when I first got my first review, I think, on Fresh Air, my father said to me, "Well, that's, you know, that's good, but, you know, radio's not going to last. It's on its way out." now I think if he could only know just how vital NPR is, and a show like Fresh Air is certainly one of the shows that publishers go to when they want to try to get the word out about a book. I didn't imagine this kind of career when I was growing up. Who could have imagined this? NPR didn't even exist when I was growing up, but I had wonderful professors in college. I went to Fordham University in the Bronx and really had teachers who were those dream teachers who, you know, would stay in their offices for hours and just talk and talk with you. And I really wanted to be an English professor. And it wasn't until I got to the University of Pennsylvania, I was working on my dissertation, and I just really hated writing in an academic style. And a friend of mine got a job at the Village Voice in New York, which Norman Mailer helped found. The Voice was known as the writer's newspaper because it would give young writers a chance, you know, writers who didn't have much of a resume. They'd give you a chance. And if they thought you were a good enough writer, you were set. So this friend got a job at the Voice, and she said, "Do you want to try to write some book reviews? And if you do, I'll try to get you an assignment." And I said, "Sure." The thrill of writing a book review and knowing that people out there were reading it, and also the thrill of being able to be funny or irreverent in a book review, as opposed to academic writing, where, especially at the time I was working on my dissertation, you certainly couldn't be funny or inject your own voice into the dissertation. It was such a thrill. And the day my mother told me that she saw somebody on the subway reading the Village Voice, and it was open to my, as she called it, my story. You know, that was just such a kick. So we started our conversation talking about public intellectuals, and I'll circle back to them. The writers and critics I revere are the people who, as you said, Charles Dickens, we talked about Janet Malcolm, Norman Mailer, people who can put ideas out there, but also write in a way to entertain, to engage, not to put up barriers to understanding. And unfortunately, I think too often that's what academic writing does.
Not to tip your hand, but you'll be talking about the power of reviews when you come to the conference and what difference a review can make.
I'm thinking about what Byron nastily said about John Keats, that when Keats died, Byron wrote a nasty little ditty that claimed that Keats had been killed by a bad review. You know, sometimes reviews can kill. They can certainly kill books, and sometimes reviews can lift up books out of the ooze, out of anonymity, and certainly it's great when that happens to a book that's deserving of it. I mean, I think recently James Wood of The New Yorker really boosted Elena Ferrante out of relative obscurity, in this country at least, when he wrote about the Neapolitan novels that Ferrante's been writing, the four of them, and all of a sudden people became interested. So reviews do have that power. I think, you know, once in a while I've been privileged to be able to do that for books myself, and even for some of our detective fiction writers who are so famous these days. I mean, Lisa Scottolini told me years ago that a review I had done really, whatever, helped shine some light on her writing. I mean, it's great when that happens. That's certainly the best thing that a reviewer can do, but sometimes reviews can kill, and I think about Gatsby. I mean, it's amazing how many nasty and bad reviews The Great Gatsby received in 1925. There's a scrapbook at Princeton University that houses Fitzgerald's archives, and the scrapbook was one that Fitzgerald kept all his life, and he's got reviews of Gatsby in that scrapbook, including one from the New York World, whose headline reads, "Fitzgerald's Latest Dud." That's about The Great Gatsby. You know that review pierced Fitzgerald, and he kept it all his life. So I do take reviewing seriously. I try not to be glib. I try not to be hurtful just for the sake of a joke. But I also try to be honest and, you know, to really evaluate a book on its own terms and what it's trying to do and whether it succeeds in doing that or not. Because I do know people rely on my reviews as a guide to what they're going to read in their precious free time.
Maureen Corrigan, book critic for NPR's Fresh Air, critic in residence and lecturer at Georgetown University. She is an associate editor of and contributor to Mystery and Suspense Writers and winner of the 1999 Edgar Award for Criticism presented by the Mystery Writers of America. She also served as a juror for the 2012 Pulitzer Prize in Fiction. She is the author of So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures, and a literary memoir, Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She is also a reviewer and columnist for the Washington Post's Book World. In addition to serving on the advisory panel of the American Heritage Dictionary, she has chaired the Mystery and Suspense Judges Panel of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre and its graduate creative writing program is presenting the Pennsylvania Writers Conference, celebrating all genres of writing and featuring workshops and panels with authors, editors, literary agents, and film producers in August. Guest speakers include Maureen Corrigan, who will address the topic, Why Reviews Matter, and Scranton native, poet, and novelist, biographer Jay Perini. Jay Perini, an accomplished writer. He has biographies including Robert Frost, A Life, One Matchless Time, A Life of William Faulkner, Empire of Self, A Life of Gore Vidal. His 1990 novel, The Last Station, about the final days of Leo Tolstoy, was adapted into an Academy Award-nominated film. He was born here in northeastern Pennsylvania, and he now teaches at Middlebury College, where he is professor of English and creative writing. The conference will take place at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre, August 5th and 6th. It opens on Friday with an open mic and poetry slam at 7, and participation in the open mic and poetry slam is open to all in the conference, and you can attend if you're part of the public but not signing up for the conference. You just have to register in advance and pay a small entrance fee. The conference attendees will have access to writing panels and workshops beginning on Saturday, August 6th at 9 in the morning, with an opening session featuring Maureen Corrigan. Those workshops will continue until 5. There'll be a break for lunch. Throughout the day, you'll have a chance to choose a workshop focusing on poetry, fiction, nonfiction, playwriting, and screenwriting. And then the keynote address will be delivered by Jay Perini at 7 in the evening. There'll be a dinner before that. And the early bird conference registration deadline is June 30th. So that's this Thursday. That's the early bird conference registration deadline, June 30th. For information about the Pennsylvania Writers Conference at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre, August 5th and 6th, wilkes.edu/PWC. wilkes.edu/PWC. There will be a writing competition for conference attendees, and all the details of how you might take part in that are on that website as well. Again, the Wilkes University Creative Writing Program hosting the Pennsylvania Writers Conference August 5th and 6th, Friday and Saturday, and it's at Wilkes University in Wilkes-Barre. For more information on the web, wilkes.edu/PWC. For Pennsylvania Writers Conference, and the Early Bird Conference registration is this Thursday, June 30th. And don't forget, you can hear Maureen Corrigan and her book reviews on Fresh Air, and we run Fresh Air weekdays at 6 on WVIA right after All Things Considered.